is Radio Times. I'm Artie Moss-Cohen. Tor Hansen writes this in his new book, Feathers Can Conceal or Attract. They can be vibrantly colored without using pigment. They can store water or repel it. They can snap, whistle, hum, vibrate, boom, and whine. They're a near-perfect airfoil and the lightest, most efficient insulation ever discovered. Hansen's book, not surprisingly, is called Feathers, and it's a lively exploration of the evolution of feathers and how they've allowed birds to develop and survive. It's also about the human attraction to feathers for fashion, adornment, and even seduction. Hansen writes about some interesting feather history, including the Trans-Saharan Ostrich Expedition of 100 years ago and the 40 cases of feathers that were lost when the Titanic sunk in icy waters. Feathers also have practical uses, as we all know, but what about poultry feathers as a biofuel? Tor Hansen joins us on Radio Times to talk about all of this. He's a conservation biologist, and he joins us from the Pacific Northwest, where he lives. And nice to have you with us on Radio Times.
Well, thanks for having me on, Marty. It's a pleasure to be here.
Well, it's a pleasure to have you here, even by telephone. And here with us in our Philadelphia studios is Nate Rice. He's an ornithology collection manager at the Academy of Natural Sciences here in Philadelphia. His primary responsibility is the care and enhancement of the world-class ornithology collection, which includes more than 200,000 bird study skins. And Nate Rice, nice to have you with us on Radio Times.
Great to be here, Marty. Good morning.
Good morning, Tor.
Good morning to you, Nate.
It's nice to have you both here. And Tor, if I could begin with you and begin with vultures and begin with a description of something that happened when you were studying vultures in Kenya. What happened?
Well, I'll tell you, I had a project going on vultures some years ago, and this is the experience that really got me thinking about feathers in an evolutionary context. And it came about because I was trying to transport a bunch of vulture food, which in this case included some rather old zebra remains, in a wheelbarrow. And part of those remains got all over me, and I realized, boy, you know, at that moment I was something like a vulture myself, except with my, you know, my long ponytail and my T-shirt, my jeans. I wasn't very well adapted to the lifestyle because it stuck to me everywhere. And it got me thinking about how vultures had lost the feathers, for the most part, on their heads as an adaptation to how they feed and as a way to help keep themselves clean and avoid bacteria and disease from this grisly foodstuff that they're eating every day. So that got me started thinking about feathers, and it's been a wonderful ride ever since.
Well, interesting to think about vultures and rotting dead carcasses as a window into feathers.
Right, yes, and nice to be chatting about it here right before lunchtime.
Indeed. Well, Nate, let me get you in on the conversation, and you come this, but yeah, go ahead.
So one of the first jobs I had in ornithology,
yes,
as an undergraduate student, helping a graduate student mark vultures. These are New World black and turkey vultures. And so the way you do it, just as Tor explained, you drag roadkills out into a field. The vultures come and feed in that field, and you shoot a net over the top of them. And they send these stupid undergraduates out to grab the vultures, and the vultures immediately vomit and defecate all over you. It's the stickiest, nastiest substance you've ever had on you.
Well,
that's how, you know, I didn't shy away from that, and here I am 20-some years later.
And this might be a first for Radio Times. We begin with vomiting and defecation as an entree into a discussion.
And dead zebras in a wheelbarrow. Perfect.
Yeah, usually you have to work into these topics, but
ornithologists start right out with it.
Well, that's interesting. Now, Nate, just another question to you, because you've been an ornithologist for, what, how many years?
20-some years,
wow.
Yeah.
And what was the spark that got you interested in birds?
I guess as, you know, any kid, I was interested in nature, and we had bird feeders as a kid, and there is an immediate attraction, you know, to feathers, the colors, the pigments, the migratory birds, and these beautiful breeding male warblers really turned me on, and I couldn't stop from there. When I was an undergrad, I took a semester off and did a fellowship studying birds, doing bird surveys, and that's what really crystallized, you know, my thought on what I wanted to be, an ornithologist, a professional bird person.
And to you, Tor, as you said, this experience with vultures made you think about feathers. What's the segue there? I realize that vultures don't have feathers on their head, but is that Is that the question that got you thinking about how did feathers evolve the way they have?
Well, it really did, in that I started thinking, my gosh, what would make a bird lose something so essential to its nature as its feathers, even just on a portion of its body? And that really sparked this interest in feathers and evolution and how they came about and how they have managed to be adapted to so many uses in nature, from their aerodynamic properties to insulation to waterproofing and to, of course, the wonderful array of colors and display.
Right. And can we think of feathers the way we might think of scales for a fish or hair even on our head, or are we talking about towards something completely different?
Well, they are also, as scales or hair, something that's part of our integument. You know, they are a skin covering. For feathers, what's interesting is how incredibly diverse they are. It's very common in nature for something to be beautifully adapted to a single purpose, but very uncommon for something to be adapted to so many uses as feathers.
And you're nodding your head there, Nate.
Yeah, absolutely. Like Tor said, you have scales and hair that protect us. Feathers just take it to a whole new level. Display, sexual selection, all these sorts of things, thermal regulation and flight. It's multi-use integumentary product.
And what is integumentary? You both have used that word. What does that mean?
Skin-related, exterior-related tissue.
Fair enough. Tor, picking up on feathers, I guess, as insulation, you talk about the golden crown kinglet and how its feathers actually allow it to, what, survive, maybe even stay warm at, what, minus 80 degrees?
It's really incredible what these kinglets do, and many other birds as well. The kinglet is a lovely example because it is really the smallest bird to stick around for the winters in the North Woods, where you have such frigid temperatures, and unlike a lot of the resident birds in that habitat, the kinglet doesn't go inside of a nest cavity or something. They don't huddle up in groups in holes in trees during those freezing nights. They really do just spend the night out on a branch someplace, perhaps with a bit of a snow covering, but they're out there in the elements. Mm-hmm. And so they rely, of course, upon the incredible insulative quality of their feathers to get through the night. And they have a very high metabolism, as all birds do, so their body temperature is up at 112, 114 degrees Fahrenheit, and it might be minus 30 degrees outside. And so you see, if you had a thermometer on the outside and one inside their feather coat, you could see, you know, as much as 140 degree or more Fahrenheit difference.
And
incredible
Nate,
insulative quality of this.
Indeed, and I guess when we think of our down jackets and down quilts, right, Nate?
Yeah.
I mean, that helps us understand the warmth properties of feathers.
Yeah, just using those feathers to insulate our bodies.
Yeah, we do it, and what's amazing is we do it in exactly the same way, and that's mm-hmm. what struck me when I was doing a project on kinglets. Here I was on this frigid night, barely staying warm, but the way I was doing it was wrapping myself in feathers, and then I thought, my gosh, these kinglets are doing the same thing in the trees around me.
And Nate, I'm assuming birds also use their feathers to stay cool as well. I mean, that they have properties that go for warmth and for cool.
Yeah, right. Birds don't have sweat glands, so they have to release in hot days like today. They release heat through their skin, and they have a subcutaneous muscle system that they can move each individual feather, and so they can fluff the feathers out, expose big pieces of skin, and mm-hmm. dump heat that way. And then opposite, you know, pull those feathers together and insulate in really cold weather.
Talk about, if you can, the collection, I guess, the bird collection at the Academy. And I had the pleasure, the honor of having a drawer pulled out so that I could look at some of these bird skins. But can you talk about sort of where that came from and why that's important?
Yeah, well, we have over 200,000 study skins in the collection. These are, you know, the skin and feathers of a bird stuffed with cotton. So the birds are lying flat on their back. Easier to store them that way rather than in a proper taxidermy pose. Virtually every species of bird in the world, both living and extinct, are represented in the collection. The Academy was founded in 1812, so we've been doing this for 200 years now. And the greatest ornithologists like John Audubon and Alexander Wilson and John Casson worked at the Academy. And so they're, you know, the foundation of the collection that they built is what we're building off of today.
And it's preserved, the carcasses, as you say, filled with cotton, and that's enough of a preservative?
Yeah, the bird skin is really thin, and so you don't need to add, you don't need to tan it like you would a leather. If you can keep the skin dry and insects away from it and dust and ultraviolet light away from it, the specimens will last for years. We have specimens in the collection from the 1750s, and there are specimens around the world from the 1600s. So they last for centuries. Birds that were prepared this afternoon, we expect to last for hundreds of years.
Wow, and still obviously traveling the world, collecting birds, bringing back the skins, bringing back the birds.
Yeah, exactly. You know, we're constantly adding to the collection. We had about 1,000 specimens a year locally, and then, you know, international trips. I'm just back from collecting in Vietnam in March and April.
Tor, let me go back to you and actually go back about 150 years to 1861, and this was the discovery of Archaeopteryx. So why was that significant? Why was that important?
Well, Archaeopteryx is a fossil famously endowed with the snout and tail of a lizard and the feathered wings of a bird. So this fossil arrived right on the heels of the publication of Darwin's Origin of Species. And it arrived at London's Museum of Natural History at a time when evolution was really the talk of the town. And it was hotly debated everywhere, from the university lecture halls to the coffee houses to the daily papers. And this fossil was just like dumping gasoline on that fire, in that it provided for Darwin's supporters evidence of a clear link, if you will, between two different groups of creatures, whereas his detractors attacked it as a fraud. And this argument went on, and boy, it's been 150 years and over 1,000 research papers later that single, or now group, of fossils of the same creature has really become what they call biology's Rosetta Stone, just a linchpin of evolutionary theory, because there is so much riding on that single fossil.
And we're almost up in a break here, but does that tell us then about where birds evolved from? The birds evolved from reptiles?
Well, we may have to get back into this after the break, but the fossil has been augmented in the last 15 or 20 years with a slew of new fossils coming out of northeastern China that are beautifully preserved feathered dinosaurs. So the story is getting better and better as we go along here with these new fossils coming out.
Well, that's a perfect segue to our break. We will pick up on that very point after this short break, and that's Tor Hansen, conservation biologist and author of a new book called Feathers, and it's subtitled The Evolution of a Natural Miracle. Nate Rice is with us here in our Philadelphia studios, ornithology collection manager at the Academy of Natural Sciences. We're going to take a very short break, then get back to our conversation. Also, if you have any questions about feathers and birds, lines open at 1-888-477-9499. We'll be right back.
Rowan University supports WHYY. In today's economy, Rowan University understands the need to continue your education on your terms. They offer graduate studies online with accelerated coursework or in a classroom setting in areas such as business, education, engineering and technology, communication, music, and more. The College of Graduate and Continuing Education is hosting an information session Saturday, August 13th. More information at rowanu.com/WHYY or 856-256-4747.
Join fellow WHYY members in New Orleans for the Jazz Event, a Ken Burns American Journeys event by Talc. Spend 5 days and four nights exploring the birthplace of jazz with special tours and backstage events at Preservation Hall, the LSM Jazz Museum, Basin Street, and other legendary institutions, plus a performance by Ellis Marsalis and a chance to meet Ken Burns. Visit whyy.org/member experience or call 877-356-4547 for more.
Those screaming children on planes, in restaurants, and at the movies. Some business owners are just saying no to kids who behave badly in public and disturb the rest of the customers. But some parents are saying, not my kid.
Think about the situation you're putting the kids in and decide whether or not this is really a place for your kid and whether they can handle it.
That's next time on Tell Me More.
This afternoon at 1 on WHYY.
This is Radio Times here on WHYY in Philadelphia. I'm Marty Moss-Cohen, and today on the show we are talking about feathers, a marvel of nature. They've allowed birds to fly, to stay dry, to keep warm, to attract mates, and to survive. Our guests are conservation biologist Tor Hansen, has written a book called Feathers, and Nate Rice, ornithology collection manager at the Academy of Natural Sciences here in Philadelphia. And just to underscore the fact that the Academy houses more than 200,000 bird study skins. And we're taking calls at 1-888-477-9499. Tor, let me go back to you, and actually then we'll segue from 150 years ago to about, what, 15 or 20 years ago. So where does scientific research stand when it comes to the evolution of feathers today?
Well, the evolution of feathers and the evolution of birds are closely intertwined. And there's a lot of new evidence now and new theory that's really making a very strong story for feathers and birds coming straight out of a particular line of dinosaurs, the theropods, which are the meat-eating dinosaurs mm-hmm. that include such famous creatures as Tyrannosaurus Rex or the Velociraptors that got everyone in so much trouble in Jurassic Park. So that line of dinosaurs shares a lot of skeletal similarities to birds. But even more intriguing now are the discoveries of specimens that have feathers, feathers of different styles and types within that line of dinosaurs. So it's really becoming a very strong story.
Nate, do you want to add to that?
Nothing specifically to that. I will say, though, thinking back to Archaeopteryx, it was this feathered dinosaur, feathered mm-hmm. reptile, but it had clawed wings, reptilian-like trait. And there's still a modern bird that has clawed wings. It's called the Hawatzin. It's a large, sort of enigmatic bird from the Amazonia.
Huh.
And just nestlings have claws on their wings, and they use it to climb up trees, sort of hitch up trees, if you will. They're lost in adulthood, but this is an ancient, 160-million-year-old trait retained in modern bird lineages.
Well, let me go back to you, Nate, and this is a really basic question, but we're talking about feathers here and birds. So how do feathers allow birds to fly?
Well, that's a great question. Tor might be able to touch on that more than I do.
I'll give you the first shot.
But there's an aerodynamic quality to them. The body feathers are contoured to be streamlined, and then the flight feathers are sort of wing-shaped, if you will, to cut the wing, to cut air, that is, to increase lift and reduce drag, the basics mm-hmm. of flight. Tail is sort of rudder-like to help to steer. Tor can probably take it from there a little bit better than I can.
You want to take it, Tor?
Sure, but that's absolutely the summary right there is in the shape of these feathers and the way they allow a bird to control drag and to control airflow around their body and create lift. It's really remarkable if you think about the shape of a wing and you're just looking out the window of an airplane, you see this airfoil shape, a curved upper surface. And if you look at a bird wing, it too has a curved upper surface that is specially adapted for lift, just like an airplane wing. But what's truly incredible about a bird wing is that in addition to that overall airfoil shape, if you look at the individual flight feathers, they too are shaped like airfoils. Mm-hmm. So with a bird wing, you really do have an airfoil made up of airfoils. And as Nate pointed out earlier, birds have the ability to control the position of individual feathers with their muscles. And so it gives them an incredible ability to control the movement of air around the wing, adjusting constantly to any change in the air pressure or temperature or wind direction. All of these individual feathers adjusting to give them great, great efficiency in flight.
And Nate, I mean, that is evolution in action, is
Absolutely,
it not?
Absolutely, yeah. The ability to fly, right.
Which and birds developing through their own unique kind of shape, their
different
unique
plans
abilities
for flight, right? Yeah, right. Soaring flight in the vultures and raptors, and continuous flapping flight in smaller birds, soaring birds out at sea, all different sorts of plans for that.
And Tor, as you were describing that, I was thinking of Icarus. I was thinking of the Wright brothers. I was thinking of all the human, and obviously the times we fly in airplanes, the human attempt to try to do what birds obviously do so naturally.
Yes, and we've been inspired by it, you know, from ancient times, you know, through our mythologies, but also very practically in the way that people have conquered the skies, if you will, through powered flight. And if you look in the writings of the Wright brothers, they were very interested in birds and the way they soar and the idea that they got for the torsion of wings to steer their early gliders and planes was directly as a result from observing birds in flight. And we continue to learn from the birds and from their feathers. If you look out the wing on many modern jets, you'll see a little fin out at the very end of the wing, and that fin has been added to a lot of planes to help reduce drag and control the turbulence that's created at the end of the wing. And that, too, was inspired by the way birds soar and splay their wing feathers at the tips, reducing the drag on the tips of the wing.
And Nate, if that weren't enough, feathers also about finding a mate, sexual selection. I mean, the kinds of beautiful feathers, obviously, playing a role, but also the things that birds do with their feathers to...
Right. Perhaps nowhere better than in the bird world do you see the effects of sexual selection. One gender selecting traits in the other gender, and then those traits becoming fixed in the population. So in your backyard, you can see cardinals, the bright red, you know, males, super males are brighter in color, and the females selecting to mate with those males based on the intensity, in part, and the intensity of the red in those feathers. And that is duplicated, you know, on every continent and in all sorts of groups of birds in the world. Birds of paradise, perhaps the most ultimate example, where the males have just long, streaming, iridescent feathers. Females are generally these cryptically camouflage pattern things,
right.
but the females are the ones controlling that in the males.
And I want to pick up on that, but let me read something that Alfred Russel Wallace said about birds of paradise. And Tor, this is in your book. You include his description, and I'll just read a couple of lines. On one of these trees, and this is talking about birds of paradise, these dancing parties. On one of these trees, a dozen or 20 full-plumaged male birds assembled together, raise their wings, stretch out their necks, and elevate their exquisite plumes, keeping them in a continual vibration so that the whole tree is filled with waving plumes in a variety of attitude and motion. I mean, what a beautiful, vivid description. Do you want to add to that, Tor?
Oh, there's so much one could add, but that quote comes from Alfred Russel Wallace's wonderful book, The Malay Archipelago, which detailed his explorations for many years in the mid-19th century in Indonesia and over as far as Papua New Guinea, where he encountered birds of paradise and provided some of the first descriptions of these birds that had been somewhat mysterious when the skins were first arriving back in Europe. They were called the birds of paradise because the legends that went along with these beautiful skins were that the birds never touched the ground. The skins often arrived without the feet attached, and so there were wild stories about these birds, and Wallace went out and actually saw them in the wild and demystified it to some degree by showing how the birds, the male birds, gather in what are called leks, a dancing party, if you will, where the males all gather and display their best postures and calls and the plumage in these elaborate dances, in effect, showing off to attract females.
Have you seen this, Nate, in your travels around the world?
There's one species of bird of paradise in Australia, the northeastern part of Australia, and I've seen that one. The rifleman or something like that. It's
the rifleman. Yeah,
rifleman.
You've seen them do the dance?
Yeah. And this loud, ringing voice. Fantastic stuff, yeah.
And does the Academy have...
We have almost every species of bird of paradise. Let me just add one point. Alfred Russel Wallace is a hero of mine, one of the greatest field biologists to ever live. But Tor mentioned that, you know, the stories were made up of the birds of paradise descending from heaven and hovering above the forests. And so the early ones were described with the Latin name of apoda, meaning no feet.
Oh.
And that name is retained to today. There's Paradisea apoda, I think, which bird of paradise without feet, I guess, is how it translates to English. But they do, in fact, have feet and don't descend from the heavens.
But the idea, a bird of paradise, the idea that wrongly, but obviously that it descended from heaven and not needing feet.
And so guys like Wallace were out, you know, professional collectors living out on a limb, you know, in the mid-1800s, just with nothing in the field, shipping these specimens back primarily to England, where they're opened by people who probably never left their office and saw these things, like Tor mentioned, without feet, and just made up stories about them. And if they'd asked Russell, you know, Alfred Russell Wallace, he would have told them
what it
was all about. Yeah.
Let me just reintroduce both of you, and that's Nate Rice, Ornithology Collection Manager at the Academy of Natural Sciences here in Philadelphia. On the telephone is Tor Hansen, a conservation biologist, and he's written a new book called Feathers, The Evolution of a Natural Miracle. And we're taking calls at 1-888-477-9499. That's 1-888-477-WHYY. Tor, let me go back to you before we get to our callers, because I want to segue from the birds of paradise to Las Vegas and showgirls that you write about in your book. And it's interesting that women in the human world have taken some of the fancy plumage of the bird world and used that as a form of seduction.
Oh, absolutely. And you know, I as a biologist have taken a lot of research trips to
Las Vegas,
various places, but this was the first time I went to Vegas on a research trip.
That's easy work if you can get it, man.
Yeah, real tough. But at any rate, it was quite remarkable to see one of these big reviews and see the way feathers were used for, you know, allurement in this garish setting, but very much in the same way that birds use them. You know, it's the manifestation of something that's been going on for thousands of years, people co-opting feathers from birds for the same uses that birds put them to. And here in Vegas, you see these incredible shows with women adorned with feathers in displays that are, you know, that can be 30-pound costumes of feathers towering off their heads and in, you know, what they call their butt pieces and these other things. And there was a showgirl who said something just absolutely brilliant. She said, you know, she gets out on stage and her challenge is to get what she calls the right amount of swish. She said, not enough swish, nobody looks at you. Too much swish and your costume falls off. And in a sense, that is the same challenge that you see for male birds, finding the right amount of swish to attract females without plumage that is so elaborate that they can't even function.
Well, and just picking up on what you said and actually giving Nate a chance to respond to that. So we're talking about Las Vegas showgirls, about 35 pounds of feathers, about 20 pounds for the headdress, then a backpack, and as Tor said, a butt piece, another 15 pounds. So butt pieces, big in the world of birds, yes?
Yeah, they are huge, yeah. Tail feathers are a big deal. And in pheasants, for example, the length and breadth of the tail can be really important to the ladies, apparently. Isn't it funny how in humans, and it's reverse, it's the women that are adorning themselves with bright colored feathers and trying to attract males?
And do you understand that, Tor?
Well,
another book, perhaps.
That might be another book, but it is interesting that it has flip-flopped here and there in different cultures, in that in some places feathers are primarily used by the men in society for status and adornment. In fact, in New Guinea, where the birds of paradise are found, it is primarily the men who adorn themselves with bird of paradise feathers. Yet in Western cultures, it's much more common, in the modern era at least, for the women to be the ones adorned.
Well, Tor, you also tell an interesting story, and this goes back to the sinking of the Titanic, and I'll be honest with you, I did not know this, that there were 40 cases of feathers aboard the Titanic, considered the most valuable cargo that was lost on that fateful day.
Yeah, really incredible, and it speaks to the value of the trade in feathers, the global trade in feathers, at the height of what they call the plume boom, which was during the late 19th century and right up until World War I, when feathers were an absolute fashion necessity for hats particularly, but also other forms of fashion as well. And at the time the Titanic sank, if you look through the ship's registry there, there were many things in the cargo hold, but the most valuable and the one that had the biggest insurance claims were these prime ostrich plumes that were going from London, destined for the hat makers of New York.
And what were the value of those feathers at that time?
In modern terms, they were worth over $2.3 million.
Wow.
That's a great story. I'd never heard of that before.
Me neither.
Wonderful.
That's great.
It is great.
You know, we should point out also
that
plume boom and the feather trade nearly caused the extinction of some species. Egrets, for example, which in their breeding plumage have these beautiful plume feathers that come out of their head and the back of their neck and the middle of their back, they were shot and just the plume feathers ripped off of them for, as Tor said, hat trade and other, you know, adornments for women. And that led to a lot of the early game laws and migratory bird laws in North America to protect those sorts of organisms.
Nate, if I can segue from that actually to last year, and I'm thinking about that oil spill in the Gulf of Mexico, the numbers of birds that were coated with oil, and we saw people cleaning them. I mean, trying to get, obviously, the oil off their feathers and allow them to survive. And as an ornithologist, I'm just curious about if that's possible to do, and is it possible to get all that oil off so that birds can actually survive and live out their lives?
Yeah, there's so much surface area on a bird's feather. You know, there's the feathers that we know about, but then there's, you know, barbs and barbules on them, and the oil just gets into every crease of that. And it really is nearly impossible to get all the oil off. But if you get most of it off, birds can retain their buoyancy, can insulate themselves, and the next molt pattern, the seasonal replacement of feathers, it's gone. You know, the direct oiling of feathers is a big deal, but then the destruction of habitat, that's the biggest thing. These offshore reefs and beds of grasses that were damaged or destroyed from that oil, you know, it'll be years and many years down the road where we see the damage done by that spill or leak, I guess it was.
And Tor, we're about 45 seconds away from our second break here. Anything you want to add to that?
Oh, only in that it is fascinating to clean one of these birds. I was speaking with someone who does this, and she said, you wash and wash and wash and rinse and rinse and rinse, and then all of a sudden, the bird appears totally dry. And what happens is that you've gotten enough of the oil out of the contour feathers so that they suddenly, the structure of those feathers retains its waterproofing capability, and all of a sudden, she says, the water starts beating up on that bird, and it's instantly dry once that structure is free of oil.
Well, let's take that short break, and we'll get back to our conversation. That's Tor Hansen. He's a conservation biologist and author of a new book called Feathers. Nate Rice is with us here in our Philadelphia studios, ornithology collection manager at the Academy of Natural Sciences, and we are talking about feathers and birds, evolution and nature, and taking calls at 1-888-477-9499. That's 1-888-477-WHYY. Stay with us. We'll be right back.
The Delaware Humanities Forum supports WHYY and presents the new documentary, Delaware's Coastal Zone Act, An Evolving Legacy, Wednesday, August 10th, 7 p.m. at Theater N in Wilmington. This film recounts the struggle to craft the visionary Coastal Zone Act 40 years ago and explores the challenges faced today to balance the desire for industrial development with the love for unspoiled natural habitats. More information at the Delaware Humanities Forum website, dhf.org. That's dhf.org. On the next Fresh Air, we talk about the books and religious beliefs that have influenced Michelle Bachmann with Ryan Lizza. He profiles Bachmann in the current edition of The New Yorker. And New York Times reporter Andrea Elliott talks about the man behind the movement to create state laws banning Sharia law. Join us. This afternoon at 3 and again tonight at 7 on WHYY.
Mm-hmm. I'm Robin Young. Join us next time for the news and these stories here and now. What if diagnosing disease was as easy as breathing? Researchers say breathalyzer tests may soon be able to tell patients whether they have anything from diabetes to cancer. Also, the best-selling book, The Help, comes to the big screen. That's Public Radio's daily digest of news and culture here and now.
Today at noon on WHYY.
This is Radio Times here on WHYY in Philadelphia. I'm Marty Moss-Cohen, talking today with Tor Hansen and Nate Rice about birds and feathers. And we're taking calls at 1-888-477-9499. Let's see what Carolyn from Glen Mills has to say. And Carolyn, go ahead. You're on Radio Times.
Thanks.
You're welcome.
I've had this birding question, which is how do birds keep their feet from freezing when it's deadly cold outside and they're doing things where their feet are exposed?
Can I toss that to you, Nate?
Birds have what's called a countercurrent heat exchange in their extremities. So warm blood going out to their toes passes very closely to the cold blood returning. And so there's an exchange of warmth from the warm blood to the cold blood. So you're not sending 50 degree below zero blood back to the heart and freezing the heart. And then it also helps to warm the toes. Yeah, in the process.
Tor, you want to?
And that's
go ahead.
And marine mammals have the same thing. You know, these whales that dive to depths where it's, you know, well below freezing in their flippers and extremities. They have the same idea, same plan.
Tor, you want to add to that?
That's exactly, I think, what happens, and it's also interesting to then think about a bird on a hot day, and they can get rid of heat by shunting hot blood down to the feet as well. So the feet are an important part of their thermoregulatory process when it gets hot out.
Well, Carolyn, there's the answer to your burning question, as you said. Let me see what Tim from Ardmore has to say. And Tim, go ahead. You're on Radio Times.
Hi. Thanks for having me on.
You're welcome.
Conversation.
Oh, I'm glad. Thanks.
Earlier, you were talking about the functionality of wings and feathers and how they work with air and everything. And then you started talking about the beauty of feathers, how they're used in attracting mates and things like that. And my question is there a correlation between the beauty of a feather and its functionality? In that is a beautiful bird that's more attractive to a female actually a better bird, a better flyer, a better hunter, that sort of thing?
Well, I'm going to toss that to our resident ornithologist here, and then Tor will get you in on that as well.
Of course, for us it's all subjective,
of course. Yes, of course.
But some going back to the birds of paradise, for example, some of those feathers that are used to attract mates have absolutely no function other than attracting mates, and in some cases they're detrimental to the health of the male carrying them. Mm-hmm. They're long, unwieldy, difficult to fly with, and so make them more susceptible to predation. Tor, anything on your end?
Yeah,
that's
form and function.
Exactly right. There are feathers that are purely for show. If you think about it also in terms of evolution and what's driving these dramatic display feathers and dramatic displays in birds, there are sort of two ideas that both have some support, and one is what they call the honest advertisement idea, whereas thinking that there is a real connection between the beauty or the amount of display that a bird does and some physical property to the bird, meaning it actually is a healthier male. It's honestly advertising that, and there's some evidence for that in certain birds. And, you know, bobolinks, for example, the ones who are the flashiest and display the longest are actually the strongest males, and then that may allow females to choose them for that. But then there's also a theory called what they call the sexy sun theory, meaning it's beauty for beauty's sake, and for whatever reason, whatever quirk of female preference, there is a trait, a long feather or a color or a pattern of color that is attractive to the females, and for no other reason than that attraction, then it becomes exaggerated over time into these incredible plumes and colors.
And Tor, I feel like I've seen that at a bar.
any high school dance.
Right? high school dance on top of that. Nate, let me pick up on something you said earlier, and this goes back to mating and sexual selection and the kind of dances that we've been talking about. You're saying it's the women that choose. So the men display in the bird world, and the women choose?
Right. So many of the birds that we've been talking about in this context display in a lek, a communal breeding ground. and males are generally in the middle, displaying against or amongst one another, and then the females are selecting mates to breed with, and they're selecting based on the length of feathers, the intensity of color, how well they can dance or sing. And so you can sit with one of these leks, and you can essentially watch evolution happening. You can see with your own eyes the biggest, brightest, loudest males attracting the most mates, you know, spreading his genes into the pool, and those traits then becoming fixed in a population.
And you can see it
in North America. You don't have to go to New Guinea. Prairie chickens, which aren't the most beautiful or elaborate birds in the world, but are great displayers. And in the Great Plains, the males congregate on leks and the females around the outside picking mates to breed with.
And when you're watching that, do you know which one that they will choose? I mean, based on the brightness of the colors, or maybe the complexity of the dance, or the loudness of their call?
Usually you can tell. Usually you can see that that there's a male, even in your backyard. Cardinals, for example, they're not doing this system exactly, but there is a brighter, redder male, and he has more female friends.
And again, I mean, there's a certain evolutionary logic to all that, right? Yeah,
absolutely. For him to carry that intensity, that's a cost. And so he has to have, you know, good genetic health, genetic fitness. And that's the cue to females that he will have great genes to pass on to her clutch.
Well, Tor, let me go back to you as a conservation biologist. I mean, evolution continues. It doesn't stop. So I'm assuming feathers, birds continue to evolve today.
Well, certainly what we know is that feathers have been around for a long, long time in essentially, or very much so, a modern form, in that the earliest fossil feathers that we have now are from a creature called Anchiornis, which was 160 million years ago, a small soaring dinosaur. And its wing feathers look very similar to modern veined wing feathers with asymmetrical veins, very aerodynamic, and all of those qualities are already intact. So feathers have been around for a long time in a very modern form. And part of the reason for that stability is how wonderfully adapted they are, and that changing from that form and often is detrimental. So we have what we call a stable long period of time where feathers have been in that form. But that doesn't mean there aren't quirks and other things that have evolved over that length of time in certain lineages, and one of my absolute favorites is a little songbird in South America called the club-winged manakin that has these bizarre secondary wing feathers, and they had mystified ornithologists for years. It was the males that carried these things, and just what exactly they were for was a bit of a mystery. But recently, a scientist named Kim Bostwick at Cornell has sorted this out by photographing these birds with high-speed digital film and slowing it down to discern that they, for all intents and purposes, these birds are playing their feathers like a violin.
Oh, wow. Oh, wow.
So it is a feather adaptation, very unique. It's just in that single species where the shaft of the feather has been enlarged almost like the body of a musical instrument that will resonate at a certain frequency. And neighboring feathers have either a pick or a series of ridges, and when the birds hammer their wings together over their backs, the picks go over the ridges and create a tone that is amplified in the body of the feather.
And Nate, you gave a knowing nod when he said the club-winged manakin.
I went to graduate school with Kim Bostwick at the University of Kansas, and so 15 years ago she started work on this project, and it's really been that long for her to uncover this mystery, this you know seemingly very simple aspect of avian natural history, you know, a decade and a half to figure out what was going on. And now she's at Cornell doing great research on manakins and other things.
Oh, yeah.
I mean, that's the great thing about birds, these obvious natural history, you know, they're obvious in nature, and you can see them and study them, and it's a great way to get at these microevolutionary type questions.
And it's great to have technology that can sort of deconstruct what it is that you're looking at.
And Kim was sort of ahead of the technology. She had to wait for that really slow frame technology to catch up for her to do these great evolutionary studies.
Well, Nate, let me go back to you, and I'm thinking about the world that we live in, especially in cities and tall buildings, and the kind of effect of, I guess, human structures on birds' evolution and their survivability.
Yeah, boy, it can be major and majorly detrimental. Some people estimate that as many as 100 million birds are killed every year in North America by running into buildings and being killed by cats and cars and wind turbines and all that sort of thing. And that's huge. That's not a surplus. That's cutting into breeding populations. So that's a huge negative impact.
And Tor, is it too soon to talk about climate change? I mean, we've had a wild series of months of weather, of heat and drought and floods. Is it too soon to sort of see that impact on birds?
Oh, not too soon at all. There was actually a study that came out, Nate, was it last year or the year before, where they looked at the data from the Christmas bird surveys, which have been going on for about a century, where in December people go out and count birds in their neighborhoods all across North America, but around the world now. But they analyze that data looking for changes in the range of birds, where the center of their range is. And they found many, many birds where that center is shifting very significantly northward, presumably in response to climate change.
The Christmas bird counts and the breeding bird surveys are great sources of data for those types of studies. But natural history museums also are great. You know, we have specimens collected by Audubon and Wilson in the 1810s and 20s, species from a specific part of the country or world that aren't there anymore. You know, red-headed woodpecker isn't found here anymore. It's moved on. Some of it is climate change. Some of it is habitat modification. But natural history collections have specimens collected at a certain date, at a certain time, and they can be used to track these changes in ranges and the causes that might be the influence for that.
Indeed. Let me see what looks like Dave from Quakertown has to say. And Dave, go ahead. You're on Radio Times.
Hi, Marty.
Hi there.
You're awesome.
Thank you.
One of the coolest things I ever saw was when I worked at the Academy of Natural Sciences years ago, where they kept alive animals. I saw an owl fly across the room to the keeper, to its keeper, and it was dead silent. And I know that's the way that they work, but how does that happen? How can they make their wings silent like that? That's amazing.
Well, Dave, let me see if Nate can answer your question.
They have on the leading edge of their flight feathers, they have little hair-like extensions that essentially baffle the sound of the wing as it passes through the air. So they are literally silent when they're flying.
You want to add to that, Tor?
Yeah, it's just absolutely remarkable. But to see a bird fly with no sound is truly incredible, and it is. It's an adaptation of the feathers with little extensions on the barbs, off the leading edge, the trailing edge, and even if you look at an individual owl feather, you'll see they're specially adapted for that. And a very interesting and intriguing example of evolution in action is that there is an owl that doesn't have that adaptation, and it is an African owl. I believe it's called the Scops fishing owl. I don't know if you have one of those in the collection.
We do, yes.
And they have everything there.
Pell's fishing owl, yeah.
and the fishing owl. So these owls are hunting fish, and so there isn't such an evolutionary advantage for silence in flight, and so they have presumably lost those little extensions on their feathers.
But then they add extensions to their feet, these little spiny-like structures on their feet, spicules, I think they're called.
Uh-huh.
And it's to help grab these slimy fish, sort of an addition to their talons, so they don't lose a fish when they pounce on it.
Let me go back to you if I can, Tor, and I'm looking at the clock here, but also you and I had mentioned this in leading up to this show, which is that we have lots of poultry feathers. People eat a lot of poultry in this country, and some thought maybe, I don't know how far along the technology is, but to use this for biofuels, where do we stand on that issue?
Oh, it's incredible. If you look through the recent patent applications, you will find processes in development for using poultry waste for all kinds of things. Biofuel, it makes a decent biofuel. There's someone making feathers into upholstery fabric. There is even a process which would be useful in our household where we have a 2-year-old dashing about, but a process to transform feathers into a biodegradable, highly absorbent, and disposable baby diaper.
Oh, that would be warm and cool, too, at the same time, right?
That's right.
Tor, what's in your freezer?
There's always something in the freezer. Yes, I have a salvage permit from the U.S. Fish and Wildlife to gather up dead birds for their feathers, and so there's always something unusual in the freezer. Right now, there's definitely a fine-looking barn owl. There's a flicker. There are certainly a couple of songbirds, but I prowl the roadsides and see what I come up with.
Is this roadkill we're talking about?
Most of what I get is roadkill, yeah, or individual feathers that have fallen in the natural molting process.
Well, we've gone from vomiting and defecating to roadkill. I think we've covered everything. Tor Hansen, thank you so much for joining us today in Radio Times.
Well, thank you for having me. It's been an absolute pleasure.
Well, a pleasure for us
as
well.
Real fun, Tor.
Yeah, indeed.
And Tor
Hansen is a conservation biologist, and his book is called Feathers. And Nate Rice, we've been trying to get you on Radio Times for many years. Thank you for joining us as well.
Real pleasure. I look forward to another visit.
Indeed. And he's ornithology collection manager at the Academy of Natural Sciences. That's here in Philadelphia. I should say the Academy houses more than 200,000 bird study skins. Go to WHYY.org/Radio Times, and you can find out much more about this program. Also check us out on Facebook, and you can follow us on Twitter, and of course the archives as well. Kevin Griffin, the engineer for today's edition of Radio Times. It's produced by Susan Greenbaum, Patty Leswing, Dennis Devine, and Debbie Builder. I'm Marty Moscowane. Thank you so much for joining us.